Hello, this is the Angry GM, and this is the Angry GM's mostly monthly live chat for the month of July in the year of 2024. And here I am again, live chatting away. And, well, I guess I should start with news. This is usually where I start when I call news, me catching up on what's going on, because it's been a month. And I started the month off very optimistic. And put out a big update right at the beginning of the month and laid out my calendar. Here's when the content is going to happen, because this was also the month where I was changing how I deliver podcasts and audio content and all of that stuff. And so I needed a really, really good solid content calendar and workflow. And unfortunately, it didn't work, is the problem. It's just not quite right. And so it's going to need some tweaking. But then, you know, that's normal. This is not like a disaster. It's normal when you change things and you, have to adopt a new workflow, that the first month of doing that is discovering the problems in the process so that you can correct them. So, of course, the biggest change now is that instead of doing a supplemental Q&A thing at the end of my proofread alouds, and whoever, basically what I was doing was I would record my proofread aloud live, and then anybody who was hanging out could ask questions at the end about the article they just heard me read out loud, and then I would answer those questions and it would provide supplemental information. The problem with that, and there were several problems with that. The biggest one was, it's kind of hard for people to, if they're just listening to me proofread through an article, which is not the best way to deliver an article, by the way, even if you like audio content, a proofread is not the same as just having the article read to you. And I'm reaching the point now where I am actually considering not doing proofread alouds, but just doing read alouds, like adding that extra step to the process so that it is a good delivery. But even then, asking people to process what they just heard, come up with questions and ask them of me, you know, sometimes there's just not questions, or people need to give things some time to marinate or whatever. And if there were no questions, then I had nothing to do with the supplemental Q&A. So I started putting out a thread so that people could ask questions in advance. And when I did that and I had five or six questions, I discovered I could, plan the content in advance, kind of script. I'm not script, because I don't do script, but, like outline my talking points, and then I could deliver things in a solid, consistent half hour and have a kind of a quality thing. Then I started to regret that I wasn't doing this for everybody, because the sort of stuff that I ended up talking about in the Q&As was really good supplemental material for all of my articles. And I wanted to make it available to everyone in the whole world, everybody who reads my stuff, not just my financial supporters. The proofread alouds are still bonus content, but I wanted to give everyone the chance to hear the clarifications and the discussion and whatever. Only supporters get to ask questions. But that whole week of the articles in early access gives everyone time to ask questions and have some conversation so that I then know what to respond to and clarify in the follow-up podcast. Plus, putting the follow-up podcast out there on other channels may help draw some attention back to my website, which is something that I'm growing increasingly concerned about. So that's why Q and Angry became a thing, okay? The problem is that there's now the workflow for just posting articles every week has become rather complex, especially trying to schedule a time in advance to record a live proofread aloud and then a time to record the Q&A, both of which I've still been streaming live via Discord as I've been recording them, even though they're no longer interactive because all the questions and everything is gathered in advance. And that's sort of like, I'm kind of not super happy with that, like, I really appreciate the interaction, the back and forth with the chat as people are listening. They type jokes or make comments or whatever, and then I can respond to that. And, you know, it's a good fun time. Sort of like the live chats. But I may have to accept that that's just the best way to deliver content and then see about making the live chats more interactive so that even if I am gathering questions in advance, which is something I like to do anyway for people who can't be here to listen live because these are all recorded, but to make sure that I'm also working in some time to interact with the people who show up. Because I know one of the benefits of showing up is that you get to actually interact, you chat with each other, and you chat with me, and then I make fun of you and call you a dork or whatever. So I've got to think about how to keep things interactive. I've got to figure out some changes to the workflow. And on top of that, I need to make some presentational changes to how I distribute the articles on the various platforms, how I post to Patreon, how I post to Subscribestar, how I post on my site, and you know how I share the news here in the Discord and the news feed. So throughout August, expect to see changes to all of those things as I tweak and revise the workflow. Okay, so that's going to be the thing. Also, although some stuff got rescheduled and bumped around here toward the end of the month, and it looks like I'm like frantically cranking out content at the last minute again, I can assure you that's not actually what's happening. This is not like in previous months where the schedule has just been killed. It's actually just workflow bottlenecks have kind of backed everything up a little bit. And I'm freeing everything up and things are coming out and it's going to be fine. And it's not going to throw off August. But it's going to need some course correction next month. That's all. So not a disaster. And that's pretty much all the news I have to share for July. It's just that. The Q and Angry thing, you know, content is coming out. I get to write a lot about true scenario design this month. I told everybody in the Q&A today how Santa Claus isn't real. So that's spoiler alert. Your kids shouldn't be listening. Like if you're playing this out loud where your kids can hear. I might spoil Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. So on to other stuff. And like I've mentioned, we do have some folks listening live, and I want to thank Procellus for producing as he does, because he's here to keep me on the time limit. But if, as you are listening, you do want to raise questions or comments that you would like me to respond to, go ahead and type them into the chat, and I will be more interactive than I have been in previous months, but use the red exclamation points and the red question marks right at the beginning to draw my eye to them, because otherwise I'm training myself not to read the chat as it scrolls. It distracts me as I type. But anyway, the next thing I wanted to mention, I want to mention this because I was talking about this in the pre-show, is I have discovered a new video game that is 2 years old, because that's how I do. What happens a lot is I discover games as they come to, become free games available through PlayStation Plus. And there is this game that I have just started playing that I am quite addicted to. And this is another in like the Dredge story of games that I never expected I would become addicted to. But this one I can honestly say that I'm actually enjoying. It is a game called Hard Space : Shipbreaker, which is an unnecessarily stupid title because it could just be called Shipbreaker and that would work perfectly fine. And I am totally addicted to it. In fact, right now, I kind of just want to call the chat early and go finish my strip down because, I'm tearing apart a particularly tricky ship right now. And if you haven't seen it, you are basically a zero-G salvage worker in a grim future. You work in a scrapyard in space. Spaceships are brought to you, and with a laser cutter and a gravity gun, you tear the ships apart. salvaging all the useful components, melting down all the metal, and tearing off all the nanocarbon plating and sorting all the bits. And I think I said that it combines the best aspects of disassembling a Lego set and putting away a board game properly while playing a game of Operation where if you touch the sides, you die. Because the ships are all loaded with hazards, electrical hazards, and fuel lines that haven't been flushed and will explode, and radiation hazards, and reactors that will melt down if you remove them improperly, and engines that will explode if you remove them improperly. It's a really fun game, and it has a really fun sort of dystopian corporate future vibe to it, where the company gives you housing and food and everything, but they charge you for absolutely every little thing. But they have all the crappy like motivational posters, and there's a little robot voice that gives you an inspirational comment every morning. Except that while I understand these are supposed to be jokes, some of the inspirational comments are actually good inspirational comments that are only jokes if you're of a certain mindset. And it's just fun. The game is fun. It has a nice tone. Except for some reason, it also decided it had to have a story, a very serious story about how terrible it is to work for a living and have to pay for things, and how evil corporations are. And there's like this whole side story where there's this girl who's forming a union secretly. The company doesn't want the union, and the union doesn't want the company, and the company is sending an investigator. And it all plays out where sometimes you get back to your, you have a fun time stripping down a ship, and then you get back to your bunk. And then there's a phone call where this woman will yammer away in your ear before you can save your game, and there's nothing you can do. You just listen to her yammer away about how terrible and miserable life is under the corporate capitalist dystopia. Okay, and that's like, it's so overbearing, and also most of it only happens in the between place. Like, you have to work a shift. You have a 15 minutes a pop, like literally a 15 minute timer running. You go out, you do a shift, then your shift is over, then you go to bed, you save your game, and then you go back and you do it again. Okay. In the between times, when you go to bed and you can maintain your equipment and upgrade your equipment and stick stickers on your stuff, which is really cute, by the way. You collect stickers and put them on, and you collect posters and decorate. It's all really stupid, cute, and funny. Except for this like miserable, overbearing thing where everybody wants to remind you just how miserable the future is and how terrible this would be if it was reality, except that it's honestly a blast. It's a ton of fun, and you're effectively immortal because every time you die, they just clone you and transfer your consciousness to the new clone. They charge you for it, but whatever. It's just such a shame, especially because the game grinds to a screaming halt to deliver. It's not even a story, because there's nothing you can do about it. It's just playing out around you. And so it just every so often the game just freezes to deliver propaganda at you. And you can find data tapes too. And you can bring the data tapes into your little house and decrypt them. And when you decrypt them, they're little just random audio logs about how miserable life would be if this was real. It's like, except it obviously isn't miserable. It's a ton of fun because it's the gameplay. So like one of the inspirational quotes of this terrible evil company is that success is not the key to happiness. Happiness is the key to success. If you love what you're doing, you will be successful. That's an evil sentiment from the evil corporation to keep you working. And I'm like, yeah, I actually love this. This is a ton of fun. Yeah, occasionally, I take a thruster cap to the face and get thrown into a furnace by accident because I didn't, secure the thing with tethers before the explosive decompression. But what are you going to do? They run off a new copy and I'm fine. So anyway, I just thought I would bring that up. If you haven't tried it yet, it's a ton of fun. There is actually a mode where you can just like strip down ships without having to worry about like the survival elements, because you do have to maintain your food or your fuel and oxygen and maintain your equipment and stuff like that. And the evil company charges you for that stuff. You know, still making a profit. I'm still digging myself out of my debt hole. So, it's fine. Anyway, the other thing that I wanted to make sure that I got a chance to mention this month, because I keep getting asked to talk about this, and I'm going to make it a point to talk about this now in every mostly monthly live chat going forward, is people keep asking me about my games, the games I'm currently running. And I am currently running two games, though currently running has kind of an asterisk at the end. So I have two campaigns going. I have an Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition campaign called Chain of Stars that is running online, though it's been on kind of a hiatus. I'm really having trouble pulling it off hiatus just because I'm because of the stuff that I talked about in the news, where every time I feel like I'm getting ahead, it's just something else is dragging me down, and then I just don't have the time to prep. So I'm going to pull it off hiatus very soon. That is the plan, but it has been on hiatus for a bit. And then I have this very sporadic game that is supposed to be twice a month in person that doesn't quite happen as often as it should because our schedule is unreliable. But that is my Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 4th Edition game, Under the Wheel, that I run on Friday, on alternating Friday nights in theory. And that at least is going semi-regularly, but there's so much time between one session and the next that sometimes it's tricky. And the thing is, I get asked to do two things. First of all, like half the people want me to talk about the rule system. Like, why are you using AD&D 2nd Edition? Or what's your thoughts on Warhammer Fantasy? And then the other half of the people want to hear actual war stories from my table and what's going on. So, and I keep putting it all off. So I've decided that every month I'm going to check in on my games. But for this month, I'm going to start and answer the people who've been asking me about the systems. And next month, I'm also going to talk about the systems. This month, I'm going to talk a little bit about AD&D 2nd Edition and why I chose it and what I like and don't like about it for just a few minutes. I'm not going to spend too long. This is not going to be a full-on review. Because, here it is. Short answer. If you're considering, hey, should I try Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition? Hell no, you shouldn't. It's awful. It's a friggin' mess. There's a reason we invented modern role-playing games in 2000, and AD&D 2nd Edition is one of the big reasons. Don't tell the OSR I said that. They're idiots. But anyway, okay. So why did I choose AD&D 2nd Edition if I'm saying that? And don't get me wrong, I'm enjoying the game immensely. You can run a game with a system that is terrible. It's easy. Look at all the people running D&D 5e. You can run a game with a system that is terrible. But anyway, why did I choose AD&D 2e? Well, first of all, I was looking with this group to start a new campaign, and we sat down and we talked about what we wanted. And one of the big selling points, and this is why I have to take the game off hiatus, or I just have to commit ritual Sudoku, is because the players basically begged me, hey, could you run something with an ending? Because, we play for a year or 2 years of a campaign and then it peters out, or there's a TPK or whatever, or it just kind of goes nowhere, or we change systems and we're getting kind of tired of it. We would like something with some actual closure. And I'm like, okay, I will write a limited story game. And initially I envisioned this campaign that would be basically 10 adventures. I do have a roadmap. It's kind of all plotted out. It's inspired heavily by Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, of all things, just not in any way that would be obvious if you looked at it, except that they got to the point where there's 5 gems and 5 dungeons, but imagine. Like that's a lot of games. So, but anyway, but apart from that, I mean, and there's a lot more to it than that. If it was just go to the 5-gem dungeons and recover the 5 gems so that you can open the way to the golden land and save the world. It's like, and like the players were playing for months before they even knew there were 5 gems and 5 dungeons. And that's a whole other thing. But I'm not going to talk about the story tonight. I want to talk about the system. The reason I chose AD&D 2nd Edition is because, well, I wanted D&D because I run fantasy, and Dungeons & Dragons is the best fantasy. Not Pathfinder, not D&D alikes. And I hate the term D&D alikes. I've noticed some people in the chat use the term D&D alike. Man, I hate that term. It makes my blood boil. If you call Pathfinder a D&D alike, that's like calling Metroid Prime a Doom clone. Anyway, so I wanted a D&D game, but I didn't want 5e, and I wanted something simple and light. I also knew, I didn't know what I was going to do at the start of the campaign. Like, I had no idea. The only thing I knew was I had to write a campaign that I could wrap up in 10 adventures, 10 to 12 adventures. That was my goal. Figure out how to write a campaign that wraps up in 10 to 12 adventures. But I had no plot. I had no starting point, nothing else. So I wanted something with random character generation so that I could just gather the players at the table and be like, okay, roll, play whatever you roll, and whatever you play, whatever you end up, you know, whatever the party I end up with, I will write a plot specifically for that group. Not necessarily a chosen one plot where, oh, and you were the people of destiny, but it is a story that clearly only these heroes could have these adventures. Okay? It's like the game is queued up to play into each character's and player's skills and preferences. And I wanted to do that very specifically. And the reason I chose AD&D 2nd, well, first of all, I wasn't going to choose AD&D 1st Edition because AD&D 1st Edition is a train wreck. AD&D 2nd Edition is just a friggin' mess. But AD&D 1st Edition is a train wreck. It is an indecipherable train wreck. Never am I going to do it. And for that matter, like I ran AD&D 2nd Edition for 12 years. It's the system I think to this day, it is still the system I have the most number of years running. I started in 1998 and then ran it straight through to when D&D 3rd Edition came out, more or less. I mean, we ran other games in there too. We tried, you know, but more like one-shots and stuff. But anyway, so, you know, I had run it for 12 years back in the day, and I think that's the longest I stuck with any system. And the other reason for AD&D 2nd Edition, because I was also considering something like Castles and Crusades or one of the other terrible retro clones like Adventurer, Conqueror, King or whatever. But in the end, what drew me to AD&D is that all of the systems that were close enough to AD&D 2nd Edition in terms of retro clones also don't have skill systems, and AD&D 2nd Edition has a system called non-weapon proficiencies, which are basically skills. Actually, it has two different skill systems. You pick one or the other or neither because they're both optional, and I chose non-weapon proficiencies. And the reason I chose non-weapon proficiencies was because I wanted the players to choose proficiencies that would be interesting, that they think would be interesting for their characters that I could then use as further plot fodder. So like when and I encourage everybody, just choose proficiencies that seem like they would be fun for your character or that speak to you in some way, because it was all random character generation. And so like the cleric chose astrology as a proficiency, and that became a major point in the game. And the elf took ancient languages and ancient history and ancient languages. So then, like, obviously we, you know, ancient mystery from the path, something involving stars. The fighter, she has a sword, an heirloom sword from ancient times, that it wasn't based on her proficiency so much. And then the dwarf fighter cleric is like he chose stonemasonry and smithing. And so it was like, well, there's an interesting story there. Why, you know, why are you a two-profession dwarf and you're a cleric? So effectively there's three professions in that dwarf. You know. So, you know, it's like that was all good elements to build a story around. And that's why I chose AD&D 2E, because it has that extra dimension with the non-weapon proficiencies. Which is a shame. If Castles and Crusades had as core a really good broad skill system, because this is the other thing I like about AD&D 2nd Edition's non-weapon proficiency system, is there's a lot of stuff in there. Okay, it's not like this limited, lame-ass skill list like we have now where there's, like, what, 15 skills and they're all useful adventuring crap. And then there's tool proficiencies that nobody bothers with or just takes at random. But, like, there's things in this like astrology and gem cutting. I guess gem cutting is a thing. But, like, dancing, cooking, weaving, fishing, heraldry, you know, herbalism, astrology, clear, obviously. Like, there's a lot of skills on this list, which is really nice for filling out the characters, you know, because it came, oh, like astrology. What could the story be if it features astrology? And finally, the big reason why I chose AD&D 2E is because I haven't done anything with it in 20 some odd years. And so I was curious, after years and years and years of running modern games, what would it be like to go back to an old school system for more than just a one shot here and there? Because I've run several different OSR retro clone things, and you know, I think I ran a basic D&D game at one point, but it was all just short stuff. Like, what would it be like to actually go back and run a campaign in this old system? And does it hold up today? And the answer is, thank God for modern game design, because it's an absolute mess. It's really just all over the place. Like, there's no consistency to the rules and the mechanics. You have to remember, on these rolls you're rolling under the number, on these rolls you're rolling over the number. To search for secret doors, you roll a D6. To test for surprise, you roll a D10, and on a 1, 2, or 3, or I think that might be a D6 also. Some things are D10, and reaction rolls 2D6 for charisma plus charisma modifier, and there's 17 different modifiers for every ability score. And it's just a complete and total mess, but it's a lovable mess. You know, it's like that picture your kid brought home from school that you hang on the fridge anyway, and it just gives you a warm feeling in your heart. Because honestly, it's the system that I really grew up on, and so, you know, I have that warmth in my heart for it. However, there are a couple of interesting things about it that I do enjoy. One of them is, as I said, the non-weapon proficiency system does have a lot of, like I was going to say there's a lot to, like there's a lot of skills on there, but also there's a good little bit about each of the skills and just, you know, not hard mechanics, but just different things that you can build around, which is really nice. It's nice having that sort of broad skill system for people to just choose from. And it has random generation, which is awesome. The whole THACO thing, so you don't have attack rolls. You have a stat called THACO, which is to hit armor class 0 is what it stands for. That's actually the number you need on a D20 to hit a target whose armor class is 0, because armor class goes down. And armor class goes down because it came from, like, D&D's roots are in wargaming, and the armor class rules origins were in naval wargaming, where a ship might have first class armor, which is the best armor. And then a lesser ship would have second class armor, which isn't quite as good, and third class armor. So armor class, And they it actually used, that's why armor class is called armor class, and that's why in the old days armor class used to run backwards. So 10th class, you know, armor class 10 was a naked screaming human being. And then armor class 0 is a plate mail clad fighter or something like that. And so it goes down. But what you do is if someone has a THACO of 20, they would need to roll a 20 on a D20 to hit an armor class of 0. You just subtract the armor class. So if they're trying to hit a naked screaming human, then it's 20 minus 10, so they need a 10 on the D20. While it's a little bit of mental gymnastics, the one nice thing about it, except it's kind of a pain, but it's also awesome, is that whenever a player makes an attack roll, I can say, okay, go ahead and attack. You need a 14 to hit. So they roll the die and they can instantly see if they hit or miss. And the number of modifiers to the attack roll are actually very limited. Most people don't have any modifiers to the attack roll. It's just, you know, so it's really nice that it's just like that quick to just resolve an attack roll. Roll an attack, you need a 13. Click, I miss. Players can just say to me, I miss or I hit. That's fantastic. The other nice thing that is also in combat that I like is the initiative system and the turn order. Because there's sort of a simultaneity that is assumed in initiative that has gotten lost. So the basic turn order is this. At the start of each round, the game master decides secretly what the monsters are going to do that round. So if there's like three goblins, I'll say, okay, goblin A and B are going to attack, and goblin C is going to hang back and shoot his bow. And once you decide that secretly in your head, you're committed to it. No fair changing actions unless the creature has genius level intellect, in which case you're allowed to pick your actions later. Seriously, that's a rule. And I actually telegraph what the creatures are going to do. I don't just select it quietly in my head. I say, okay, look, the goblins are, you know, they're still brandishing their swords, getting ready for another attack. And the archer is taking aim and getting ready to take another shot so that the players actually know what the monsters look like they're planning to do this round, which is also great. Then the players declare their actions. Then initiative is rolled and declared act. Like there is an optional rule where declared actions modify your initiative. That's actually optional. But anyway, so then the actions play out. If there's a tie on the initiative, both actions happen simultaneously. Otherwise, you go in initiative order. Right, and if you're using the optional rule with modified initiatives or individual initiatives, then creatures will go at different times. What that means, though, is that sometimes your action that you declared may not ultimately be possible. Like if you declare an attack and the you know everybody is moving faster than you, and the tide of combat carries all your targets too far away for you to reach, you know, then you're out of luck. So you have to be careful when you declare your actions to make sure that, you know, what you're planning to do, like the chaos of battle won't make what you're doing impossible. I'm actually using a set of optional rules called the Combat and Tactics System, which makes all this initiative stuff even more interesting and gives players the ability to kind of recognize which creatures are faster, which creatures are slower, and figure out, like, if the creatures are faster, then it's better to hang back and let them come to you. And if the creatures are slower, then it might be better for you to charge them, or it might be better for you to use faster attacks, or things like that. So you can start to game the initiative system. And then because I'm also telegraphing, suddenly the players are being able to be very responsive in declaring their actions. And then everybody declares their actions, and I have to scribble little notes so that I know what everybody's going to do in the round. Then initiative is rolled, and then the actions just go off when they go off. So I really, really like that. I really find it much more engaging than just straight up everybody rolls initiative and then, okay, it's your turn. What do you do? It's your turn. What do you do? It's your turn. What do you do? It's like, okay, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Okay, let's roll initiative and see if that's actually what happens. And so that's something I really love about AD&D 2E. But anyway, next month I will talk about the Warhammer system. And I will make sure that I leave myself time because I'll have a lot to say about it. And I want to start addressing questions that people sent me in advance. And also, if anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to put them in the chat and I will check in with them periodically. Like I just glanced right now and see that there haven't been any, but that's okay. But before we move on, I want to announce a new feature of the Mostly Monthly live chat. And that is the Angry Puzzler, okay? So I am going to every month pose you a puzzle, riddle, or challenge and invite you to try and answer it, okay? If you ever listen to Car Talk, the old NPR radio show with the Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, actually Tom and Ray Milyazi, but... it was a really funny show about cars, car repair, and also they were just hilarious because I don't give a crap about cars. I'm not a car guy. But one of the things they did every month or every week was they would ask a puzzler and they would invite people to send in the answer. And then they would, from all the right answers, they would select one winner at random. And that's what I am going to do. So I am going to pose you a puzzle. And then I am going to invite you to send me your answer. And then I will go through the answers. If you're listening to the recording, you can do this too. This isn't just for people listening live. This is anybody who hears my voice right now. You know, email it, unless it's August, in which case you're out of luck. Well, if it's after August 7th. Okay, because there is going to be a deadline. So you think you have the answer? Email it to me. There is no bonus for showing your work, okay? Like if there's a logic puzzle or something, you do not need to write me an essay about how you arrived at your answer. I don't care. You need to give me a right answer. And like, I don't need to read 10 paragraphs to figure out if you have the right answer or not. In fact, if I can't tell at a glance whether you have a right answer, I'm disqualifying you. And I may announce your name as somebody who had to be disqualified so that I can incentivize the proper behavior here. So just give me the answer I ask for, nothing else. Email it in, and then I will select one random correct answer to receive a prize, except I can't give a prize because of legal raffle laws. So I will give you a non-prize. And the non-prize this time around, I will award you a pair of +5 smarty pants. Okay, if you are the randomly selected correct answerer. So now listen carefully as I present you the first puzzler. You are foolishly the only member of the party to have wasted a proficiency or skill or whatever on crafting. And so while the rest of your party is out having a good time in their between adventure rambunctiousness, you are stuck in your alchemy lab crafting the party's supply of healing potions. And the party has instructed you to craft as many healing potions as you possibly can. Your lab is very well stocked. You have all of the basic ingredients you need and all of the vials you need to craft an infinite number of potions, but for one ingredient. For I don't need to tell you, but every healing potion needs the juice squeezed from one life berry. So one life berry, squeeze the juice, and that is the final ingredient to make the healing potion. You can make as many potions as you can, but for the fact that you have no life berries. The party has given you, however, 1,000 gold pieces from the party fund to make all of the potions you can, and because you foolishly chose to be a lawful good character, you are not allowed to skim any money off the top. You must use all 1,000 gold pieces to make healing potions. You have found an elven grocer who agrees to sell you one life berry per gold piece. Okay? Now, being an alchemist, you also know that every life berry contains a life berry pit. You don't need the pit, you just need the juice. You crush the life berry, squeeze out the juice, bam, healing potion done. And then you're left with the pit. But the pits are useful for growing life berry bushes. The grocer agrees to trade you one life berry for every 4 life berry pits that you bring to him. Now, this is downtime, and the game master is away on vacation, so he can't resolve any actions, so you can't go hunting the wilderness for more life berries or stealing more life berries from you know, our herb gardens around the town. You just have to go with the life berries you've got. There's no other way to get life berries but buying them from this grocer. But he will then trade you one more life berry for every 4 life berry pits. So with your 1,000 gold pieces and your infinity of other ingredients, how many potions of healing can you outfit your party with? If you think you know the answer, email it to angry.puzzler@angry.games. That's Puzzler, P-U-Z-Z-L-E-R, @angry.games, by August 7th, 2024 at noon, at which point I will select one random correct answer to receive a pair of +5 smarty pants. And that is the Puzzler for the month. And now I shall move on to the Q&A portion. And this is a good time where if you have any questions or comments that you would like to add to the pile I already have, you go ahead and type them out. Also, it goes without saying, it's like, don't put the answer in the chat or something else. BC56 is asking, what's the capitalization on that email address? Email addresses are not case sensitive. Okay? It's just... angry.puzzler@angry.games. Okay. So you can capitalize all of it. All right. Q&A. So first question comes from Misspelled Kate, who wants to know, have I read any good books lately? And actually, I am currently reading what I would call a very entertaining book, which is called Catch Me If You Can by Frank Abagnale. And of course, many of you will probably know that title because of the Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio that came out some years ago. I'm actually stopped in the middle of my delivery to look up when it came out. So it was 2002. So it came out 22 years ago. For all of you who needed to feel a little older tonight, 22 years ago is when Catch Me If You Can came out. It is the dramatization of this book, which is a memoir written by Frank Abagnale, who is a he was basically a con artist, and his claim to fame was that he basically impersonated a pilot to cash phony Pan Am payroll checks, while also taking advantage of a pilot's ability to fly for free, so that he could fly around the world, cash phony payroll checks. And as he did this, he disentangled the entire check cashing system and came to understand how checks are cleared and how they're moved between banks. And he got more and more sophisticated as time went on and wrangled, you know, millions and millions of dollars before the FBI finally caught up with him. Though he did get caught several times and put in jail in several places. He also briefly impersonated a pediatrician And like one of the more famous exploits is that he managed to pass the bar exam in Alabama and then pretended to, it's not really pretended to be an attorney, except that he had to falsify credentials to be eligible to take the bar exam. So he was still a fraudulent attorney. And then he worked in the district attorney's office for some time in Alabama. And then he eventually got caught. And then after he served his time, he became a security consultant and an anti-fraud expert. He got famous for helping to design lots of anti-fraud security features on old paper checks and even some of the currency security features on currency that we have now. He was actually a very famous figure, and I had heard of him before the movie made him famous because I studied... No, I guess that's not true because it came out in 2002. Huh. All right, I guess because we did talk about him in like auditing class when I was getting my accounting degree. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The reason I am reading this book now, I had never read it before, and it's very entertaining. It was written back in 1980, and the style is very conversational. It's a bit braggadocious, but also Frank presents himself as sort of a, he knows he was a criminal, and he is humble about that, and he admits what he did was wrong, but he also, you know, he had standards, and he didn't really defraud people, or so he said. He would go after banks and big companies and things like that, the whole scoundrel with a heart of gold thing, which is kind of iffy because he was also a bit of a womanizer and got into a lot of relationships and, you know, and used some of those relationships to get access to some resources. Like he was in a relationship with a woman in France, and her father had a printer shop, and he defrauded her father to print phony checks, you know, so as, you know, make of it what you will. But the reason I'm reading it is because I recently learned that 2 or 3 years ago, another book came out by a guy named Alan C. Logan, an investigative reporter. The book is called The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Catching the Truth While We Can, because everything needs a colon and a subtitle. And it is apparently a new expose that reveals that the con man's memoir is actually full of lies, and that the story isn't quite what he said, and he wasn't as brilliant as he said, and also he was kind of a lot scummier than he said. And I was very curious about the memoir, or not the memoir, I was very curious about the expose and wanted to read it, but I realized I'd never read the original book, so I bought the book and the expose, and I'm currently in the middle of reading the book, which is very entertaining, and now I'm curious to see what the truth is. But then again, like, I guess it shouldn't be surprising that a man whose claim to fame is being the greatest fraudster and con man on earth might have lied in his memoir and given, you know, and played it up and made himself seem like this dashing, debonair, like criminal James Bond type hero guy. So, yeah, imagine that. The con man was a liar. Anyway, Mendel asks, why is Bloodborne the best Souls-like? Which is correct, though I still haven't actually played Sekiro yet, and I have a feeling that when I do finally get around to Sekiro, I might say Sekiro is the second best for some of the same reasons. So why is Bloodborne the best Souls-like? And I'm going to assume that those of you who are listening to this have some knowledge of Souls-likes because I don't feel like explaining all the friggin' mechanics again. Also, I hate the term Souls-like, by the way. They are the Soulsborne games. Anyway. One of the things Bloodborne did very well was that it limited the number of character builds. There wasn't this big, extensive, you know, pile of character builds where you could do light armor, heavy armor, 10,000 different weapons, whatever. There was a very limited number of weapons with a limited number of move sets, and the armor didn't affect your mobility. So everyone kind of had the same speed, dodginess, and those basic capabilities. And because they knew that every player had the same basic capabilities defensively, they were able to actually tighten up the combat design to a great degree. I mean, Bloodborne is a much more aggressive, fast style of combat, but its moveset also lends itself to that. And the, you know, the whole thing with the trick weapons, like you have a weapon that transforms into two different forms, but beyond that, you have a gun, you have the one weapon, it has two different forms. So you have sort of a very limited set of options. There's still a lot of variety in the weapons themselves. So playing a threaded cane guy is very different from playing like a hunter's axe guy, and they're all different from playing like a righteous spiraler guy or the like the Ludwig's holy wagon wheel guy or whatever the hell all the stupid things are. I don't know, because as with all Soulsborne games, I tend to find one of the starting weapons that I love and just stick with it through the whole game. I just like, you dance with the woman you brought. That's just how it be. So it's like, I'm like, I did my first playthrough with the threaded cane. I did my second playthrough with the saw cleaver. And I'm like, okay, that's all, you know, I don't need to know anything else about any other weapons. But that really allowed them to tighten up the combat design and make every combat it was a much more consistent experience. There weren't many combats that were like, oh my, this is just awful. And there weren't many combat, there also weren't many combats that were like amazing until you got into the DLC. You just had this tighter design. The next thing is that Bloodborne was atmospheric in a way that even the Souls games couldn't manage to be, because at the end of the day, yes, the Souls games were dark and there was a decaying world filled with undead, but it was still sort of this, you know, it was just a crumbling fantasy world. Like you've seen a thousand of them before, filled with undead and dragons and stuff and demons, you know, whereas the Victorian aesthetic combined with the combination of Germanic and cosmic horror, led itself to a tremendously atmospheric game. The game is also shorter and more tightly paced than any of the other Souls games. It takes many fewer hours to beat Bloodborne than it does to beat any other Souls game. And because of that, there's a really good tight pacing to it. There's a very good act structure to it that is conveyed in the world. So you can actually see the world changing as you proceed through it. Okay, where things are getting worse and worse and worse and worse. There's a passage of time mechanic. And thematically, it's also paced very well in that in the first act, you think, oh, okay, we're doing the Victorian steampunk, I'm fighting werewolves thing. And gradually the game transitions itself from being standard Victorian Germanic European horror Gothic horror is the word I should be using. For being standard Gothic horror to, oh, shit, we're doing Cthulhu, are we? And it transitions itself so beautifully that you don't notice that it's moving from the one kind of horror to the other until you're already really deep in the Cthulhu horror. And then when you look back at the whole game, you're like, when did it switch? When did it go from first to third gear? Because I should have felt that. And it does it so seamlessly. It really is beautiful, okay? Bloodborne is not the best just because of its mechanics, but it's the best because of its mechanics, its story, its theming, and its atmosphere, and its setting, okay? That's why. Borrow wants to know, what would you say to GMs who doubt themselves? I have two answers here. The first answer I would say, who cares? Who cares if you doubt yourself? You know, you got to do it anyway. Confidence is not a requirement for you to do things, okay? Like, you doubt yourself, you were, oh, I'm not going to do good at this. Who gives a shit? Do it anyway. If it's worth doing, do it. You know, why do you need esteem? Why do you need confidence? Confidence is the sort of thing you gain from doing things. It's not a prerequisite, okay? But here's the second thing. Lack of confidence is par for the course. There are not many GMs who are actually confident in themselves. Many GMs doubt themselves pretty much all the time. I still have tremendous amounts of self-doubt. Now, that's not actually completely healthy, to be totally fair. Most people who doubt themselves at one thing, they doubt themselves at lots of things, and that's because they have self-confidence issues, at which point, well, you know, that's all a separate thing, and I'm not giving any advice on that front. But as far as GMing and doubting yourself, it's like, I don't care. Hold your nose and do it anyway. Okay. Nox Aeternus. If I could choose one tabletop role-playing game I have never run to try, or I've never run to try out, which one would I try and why? And this is tricky because, like all game masters, my bookshelf is full of role-playing games I bought because I was interested in them and that I have never gotten a chance to try them and would love to. And that's, by the way, why I'm running Warhammer Fantasy 4E right now for the one group, is because it's one of those games that's been sitting on my shelf that I've been curious about that I never got a chance to run, and now I'm running it. So if you had asked me, like 6 months ago, Warhammer Fantasy probably would have been my answer. But I'll tell you, I have been curious for a while about the Modiphius Games 2D20 system. Modiphius Games being the company. And their games use what they call the 2D20 engine. And I don't know anything about it mechanically, but I've been especially interested in their game Conan. Now, the thing is, as much as I would love to run the Conan role-playing game, I'm not actually a big fan of the Conan books and movies and don't really know much about the universe. I mean, I know some. I know more than lots of people, but, you know, I don't know it frontwards and backwards. I'm not a lore wonk. But then again, I really don't know anything about the Warhammer universe, and I'm running that just fine. So I'm sure I could wrap my head around it. But there's a lot of interesting things going on in Conan. And one of the things I like about it is that each skill has its own little skill tree. So that as you put points in a skill, you unlock modifiers and bonuses pertaining to that particular skill. It has a very interesting, semi-random, sort of curated character generation system that I would love to see in action. And I really don't know anything about the core mechanic because I haven't even had a chance to read the book yet, because I'm not going to read it until I have an opportunity to run it. But if I could just run one RP, like if I could get a group that agreed to meet for 3 to 4 sessions over the course of 1 to 2 months and would play any game I offered to run, that would be the game I would choose. Like if there were any takers out there who were like, you know what, Angry? I will sit at your table and play any game you want to run for, you know, 2 to 3 months of, you know, two to four sessions a month. And I just ran it as a one shot. That would be the one. Andrew wants to know, how did you feel about recording the first Q and Angry? And I kind of covered this at the start of the whole thing, because I talked extensively about Q and Angry and how I feel about it. But I will say that I was actually extremely proud of the first two Q and Angry recordings. They were really tight. I was on the ball on my delivery. I kept everything flowing, and I nailed the pretty much the exact time I wanted to, because I wanted it to be 30 minutes long. One was 28:59, and the other one was like 29:30 or something like that. They were all right there within that last minute. I left no information out that, but to keep it under time. I didn't have to fill any time. They really came out good. I really like this scripting in advance and, you know, then just doing the delivery. It's sort of an extemporaneous delivery from basic bullet notes. So they came out really good. Today's didn't come out so good. I am not proud of it. And beyond that, I do really regret that it's not as interactive, which once again, I sort of regret the lack of interactivity here, the live chat. It's giving people less of a reason to hang out for the live chats because there is no interaction. And I am going to need to find some ways to fix that. But I covered all that already. So moving on. Guy Quail, who betrayed me. How do you portray respectfully NPCs of other races and cultures when you are running games set in the real world? And man, is this a loaded question, and probably one of the best reasons not to run games set in the real world, especially in 2024, unless you absolutely know the players you are sitting with, because that is just going to be a landmine of cultural respectivity, let's say. But it's the sort of thing that I also personally don't sweat that much. The way I see it is this. If in your heart you actually do treat other people's cultures and beliefs and faiths and opinions and all of that stuff with respect, I'm not even going to mention race because I race is like a not thing. Right, but culture. You treat people's cultures with respect. You treat people's religions with respect. You treat people's opinions with respect. If you can honestly say you respect everybody's opinions and beliefs and all of that stuff, and their cultures and their heritages, and you do so, then there's not much of a danger that you're going to portray these things disrespectfully. So me, I'm very respectful of pretty much everyone, except in the role-playing space. Like, if you have the wrong role-playing game opinion, I do not respect you, okay? But, like, I myself, I'm a longtime atheist that is gradually sort of going through discovering my own path, going through discovering faith now. But, like, I have always been respectful of basically every religious belief, treating all of them with respect and trying to understand them. And, you know, I've demonstrated that, but I say that one firmly because I have friends of deep faith and members of this community of very deep faith who have reached out to me purposely to thank me for the way I treat them. And they're often surprised to discover that I was for a long time a textbook thumping atheist. And I'm still, I guess the best I can call myself now is agnostic, but you know, and it's the same with cultures. Like, cultures aren't monotheistic or monolithic, not monotheistic. There are monotheistic cultures. Cultures aren't monolithic in the real world, right? There are general cultural trends and tendencies, and you can kind of understand them, but any given individual may or may not match them to a greater or lesser extent, so you can't really assume much about people by their culture. And so it is important for you to understand where cultural influences end and individual personality begins. But again, if you hold respect for people in your heart and can look yourself in the mirror and say, truly, there is no one I disrespect on the basis of culture, race, political belief, opinion, whatever. Like, I don't agree with the flat earthers, but, you know, to a certain extent, I respect them. You know, they're not right. And I will, you know, if I get into a debate with them, I will certainly stridently defend the round earth hypothesis. But like, I also don't hate them or make fun of them because, you know, they're just people. At worst, they're misinformed, you know? So that's the thing. If you hold it in your heart to respect everybody, then you won't portray people in a disrespectful way. And if you do make a mistake and somebody's feelings are hurt, then you just apologize. You're like, hey, you know, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean to be disrespectful, and I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry that I was disrespectful. That's it. You apologize and you move on. And if the people, look, if you have to worry about this, either because you're concerned that you will act disrespectfully or the people at your table will take your portrayals as disrespectful. If you're either afraid of how you'll do it or how your players will respond to it, then there's a problem there that has nothing to do with the portrayal of NPCs. Okay, there's another issue going on there that you need to look long and hard at. Okay, but I... I've gone far enough on that. Mendel, do quest markers hinder player agency? And I assume we're referring to quest markers in video games, like where the markers for your next objective light up on your mini map or, you know, on the in-game map so that you know where to go, or they show up on your HUD in some way to guide you to your next objective. Do quest markers hinder player agency? This is an interesting question because I cannot figure out for the life of me how quest markers would affect player agency. I can think of a very good reasoned points as to why quest markers might detract from the gameplay experience. I can also think of a number of good points as to why quest markers improve the gameplay experience. Okay, but nowhere on the list would I even think about player agency. Because, like, marking a destination or a location on a map does not force someone to go to it, or does not take away from them that they can't go anywhere. Like, invisible walls might affect player agency, right? Like, if you can't go anywhere but the quest, that could affect player agency. But that also doesn't necessarily affect player agency. But the broader point here is, who cares? Player agency is a myth. And I've been talking a bit about that. Like in next week's Q and Angry, you're going to hear a discussion about why player agency is actually a myth. It's not really a myth, but it is. But it's the sort of thing that you should probably worry a little less about. Okay? Like, player agency has become a buzzword. It's become akin with like railroading and metagaming as one of those terms that everybody talks about that doesn't matter nearly as much as you think. Okay. Basically, player agency is there until it's not. It's not a thing that is helped or hindered. It is not a thing that has gradations. It is just a thing that if it's broken, players are unhappy. When a player feels like, you know what, I don't feel like I have any say in my destiny. I have no control over what happens in the game. Okay, but actually, how players can have control in a game varies greatly. And it doesn't really matter what way players have control over the game, as long as the players feel as if they have control over the game. So, Nori. Nori wants to know if I have any thoughts on worrying about wasted turns in tabletop role-playing game design. And I love these questions where it's like, it's just, what are your thoughts on that? I'm going to throw out a random phrase here, and you just pontificate on it. Wasted turns in tabletop role-playing game design, which this is another one of those hot-button issues where it's like the idea that if a player makes an attack roll on their turn, and the attack misses, they have wasted their turn, which is a travesty. And so there should be mechanics to prevent a turn from ever being wasted because they have rolled and taken an action and failed. Okay? And me, as you can probably tell from my tone, I don't really think much about this. I don't care about it. I actually think it's wrong-headed to worry about it. Okay, because to me, that's not actually a wasted turn. Okay, waste is a thing that you throw away because it is, you know, it's meaningless, it's nothing, it's extraneous, it's left over. That's not a wasted turn, okay? That's a problem that you now have to overcome, is you got one action and you rolled your attack roll, it didn't work. So now, not only did you not do any damage, but you may be in a bad position because now you're going to get hit. Okay? That's a negative thing. It's not a wasted turn. It's a failed turn. You failed. Your character failed on your attack, and now there's going to be consequences. okay? Because you're never going to get that attack back. You're never going to get that turn back. It is gone. Maybe next time you should, you know, devote some resources to getting a bonus on your attack roll or attack something whose armor class you're more likely to hit. Or sometimes you just get unlucky, and that sucks too. But you know what? Sometimes you get unlucky. That's the cost of playing a role-playing game. So no, I don't consider like a miss in combat or something like that a wasted turn. Here's an example of a wasted turn is when I say, what are you going to do this turn? And the player goes, pass. I don't know. I'll wait until next turn. That's a wasted turn. Okay. But a turn in which a player attempts an action and the action doesn't work, and now they have to deal with the consequences of having just used up a resource to get nowhere, and now they're, you know, the enemy is going to come back at them. That's actually a failure and a problem, and that's how combat should be. Okay, Ralphius, if you were going to advance your timeline in your game by a century, what's the most important question you'd ask yourself? This is a fun question, right? This is like one of those nonsensical questions. Like, if you could be any kind of tree, how would you change the world for the better? Right? Like, if you were going to advance your timeline by a century, what's the most important question you'd ask? It's not like, how can I do that? Or, what things should I consider if I'm going to do this in my game or whatever? It's what's the most important question you would ask? So the most important question I would ask myself, if I were going to advance the clock on my campaign by a century, I would ask myself, why the hell am I doing this thing? Why am I thinking that advancing the clock on my campaign by a century is a good idea? What the hell am I actually... Oh, I'm sorry. I just stepped on Biscuit's tail. I'm so sorry, sweetie. I didn't know you were laying right behind me. She's okay. She's okay. She's giving me the stink eye, but she's okay. Okay, why the hell are you doing this thing? What are you hoping to accomplish? Why is that better than, I don't know, starting a new campaign? What the hell happened in your campaign that you have to run the clock out by a century? What's happening with the player characters? Are they moving forward in the future? Are they dead? What's going on? Like, so that's the question that I would ask myself is, what the hell am I trying to accomplish by doing this? Okay. Father Fan would like to know what some of my favorite mysteries are. So I, apart from the Sherlock Holmes books, where I have read every Sherlock Holmes novel, short story, novella written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and absolutely nothing written by anybody else. And that's actually a really mixed bag, honestly. There's a couple of different styles. But I don't know, and I love them, but I don't know that I would call them my favorite mysteries. If I had to pick my favorite mysteries, I would say the USA series Monk and Psych. Those two shows, both, you know, they're both basically procedural mystery stories starring a quirky detective. And those are my favorite mysteries, hands down, especially the early seasons. Both of them did kind of lose their way in about the fifth season. And I think it's just because it was kind of, like things kind of run their course. But for the first four seasons in both of those shows, they were exceptionally good at presenting you with a mystery and making sure that the viewer had all of the information needed to solve the mystery before the detective. Okay. Which is what I like. Okay, so in fact, me and my cousin, we used to get together every Friday night when they were on and watch Monk and Psych. And what we would do is at the 43-minute mark, because we were watching them on cable television, so they were commercials, so they were hour-long shows, even though they were 45 minutes long. But at the 43-minute mark, that was always when Monk or Psych... Sean Spencer would say, okay, here's how it happened. Okay. And then we would pause it and we would see like we would each get a guess. We would each, you know, like, oh, I think it was, you know, the astronaut did it because he rigged up, you know, he strangled his wife and then he tied the noose and then he tied her to a garage door opener so that she would be hung while he was in orbit. And, you know, and that's why the garage door opener, the neighbor's garage door opener was on the wrong circuit because he had switched them so that the guy would hang his wife. Okay, you know, that kind of a thing. But all the information was there and you could solve the mystery. And that's what I love most about a mystery. And also, the mystery never required esoteric knowledge and it was never solved by technobabble. Okay, it was never solved by some detective coming out and saying, we ran the DNA through the spectrometer sequencer and we've discovered that actually the brother is the brother was at the scene or whatever. And it's like, okay, the brother was the killer, whatever it was. Okay, it's actually just solved by noticing the details in the environment along with paying attention to the dialogue. Those are my favorite mysteries. Okay. Misspelled Kate. So we have another one of these, if you could only do one. So Misspelled Kate says, if you were trapped on a desert island with enough gaming supplies and the rule books for just one role-playing game system, assuming you were trapped there with four or five of your favorite players, what one role-playing game system would you want to be stranded on the desert island with? And I didn't even have to think about this. I just wrote it down very quickly. It's Dungeons & Dragons 3rd.5th edition. Version 3.5, Dungeons & Dragons. Hands down, that is the game that if I could only run one game for the rest of my life with my favorite players, that would be the one I would run. I'm not going to expound on that only because I've expounded on why Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 is the best edition ever and beats pretty much every other game of its ilk, including Pathfinder, by the way. D&D 3.5, better than Pathfinder, okay? Better than Pathfinder 1. I've never played Pathfinder 2. I've read a bit of it. And I can firmly say D&D 3.5, better than Pathfinder 2. So, but then a lot of things are better than Pathfinder 2, which I can say without even playing it. If you think Pathfinder 2 is the best game, you're wrong. So, and I don't have to be respectful of that because as I already said, I am respectful of all people's beliefs, opinions, cultures, everything. Except when it comes to role-playing games, I do not respect people who think Pathfinder 2 is the best game. And the only reason I'm bringing that up, and I've gone on kind of a crusade against Pathfinder 2, is because, man, the Pathfinder 2 thumpers have been after me for a while. They've been trying to convince me I keep seeing in conversations, and I'm not necessarily saying on the Discord, I'm not accusing anybody in my community of this, because every time I say anything, like there's certain members of my community who immediately go, oh my God, was it me? Did I do it? It's like, no, not necessarily. I pay attention to lots of community. I actually lurk in a lot of places online, okay? I have accounts in a name other than the Angry GM in places so that I can pay attention to what's going on and then I don't participate in the discourse. I just watch. Okay, Pathfinder 2E is currently the game that solves all the problems. So whenever anybody puts forth a complaint about, oh, D&D does this, or, you know, I'm playing whatever other game and it's doing this or whatever, somebody wants to tell you exactly why Pathfinder 2 solves that problem. And it's obnoxious. And it's not the first game, by the way, that does that, that had obnoxious fans, okay? Blades in the Dark was that for a while, where every time you said anything about D&D, somebody was like, hey, you know, Blades in the Dark, it's got clocks. It's awesome. Dungeon World was that for a while, where, and then there's also a bunch of both retro clones and 5e hacks and Black Hack and stuff that also get some of that, like, oh, if you hate that, you know, just go with the Black Hack or six levels, right? There's the game that there's only six levels of play and it boils every, it streamlines everything. It boils it down to six levels. Okay. So the Pathfinder 2 fan base has just started to annoy the shit out of me because their response to every discussion is, let me tell you how awesome Pathfinder 2 is. Hey, do you have a minute to learn about our Lord and Savior, Pathfinder 2? And then they like kick down your door and come in and they're throwing like brochures at you. Okay. Guy Quail, this is my final question. And we're just about at the 90-minute mark. So I was kind of right when I said the amount of time I would need. Because I did say an hour and 15 to an hour and 30. So Guy Quail asked, and this is a really fascinating question too, because I like to read these questions between the lines. Why should a GM not host the game at their own home? This is an interesting question because this is one of those questions where it seems like I'm being asked to justify something I said. Okay? Where it sounds like Guy Quail is asking me this because at some point I said game masters shouldn't host the games in their own homes and wants to know why I said such a thing. I don't recall ever saying such a thing. Maybe I did. Like, the problem is sometimes I make flippant remarks, especially in my writing. Like, sometimes I'll make a joke like, and, you know, unless you're dating one of your players, and you should never ever do that because being friends with your players is a conflict of interest. And then people think, oh my God, are you serious? You're never friends with your player. I'm like, no, that, like, can you not tell the difference between a flippant joke and actual advice? Okay. But whatever. Okay. So I might have said it flippantly, but I don't think I ever said it. If it's not me being asked to justify something I've said, then this is a great example of something called begging the question, which is where there's another question to be asked here. And should the game master not host games at their home? Is this a thing game master just should not do? Because the thing is, questions like this lend themselves much better to what are the benefits and what are the costs or risks of running the, of hosting the game in your own home. Like, what are the good points? What are the bad points? That's a good question to ask here because there are good points and bad points. But I was only asked half a question, which is what are the bad points? To which the only thing I can really think of is it's kind of a pain to have people over when you get down to it. I mean, you got to set up the furniture, you got to clean up after everyone leaves, you know, maybe serve snacks and, you know, vacuum the rugs, get the mayonnaise off the ceiling, whatever else. You know, hosting people is a pain. And given that you're doing all the game prep stuff anyway, and you've got to run the game and plan everything and schedule it and do all that other shit, it's kind of nice if somebody has to worry about the whole hosting thing and like set out the table and put the chairs around the table and whatever. That's about the only reason I can think of. Also, if you're running a game for strangers, you may not want them to have your address, especially if you game master like I do, and you are both a killer game master and adversarial and abusive about it. There have been times when it has not been to my benefit that players knew where I lived after some of the shit I did to them in the game. So in those cases, yeah, it's best if you're running at someone else's house. Those are the two things I can think of. I can also think of a lot of benefits. If you had asked me what are the benefits, I could tell you. And if you could had asked me which I preferred, I could tell you that too. But unfortunately, that's not the questions I asked, and that would be against the rules of the Q&A portion, which is now over, and that also brings this episode of the Mostly Monthly Live Chat to a close. So I want to thank Arthur, BC56, Cycloptic Squirrel, Jinbei Fong, Jorkon the D10, and Wes Belmont for hanging out. And I know Decurion was here for a while, and I think one or two other people drifted in and out. Who I kind of lost track of. Proselys, thank you for producing, even though I once again didn't need you to produce. thank you everybody who is both listening live and listening to the recording for your ongoing and continued support of my work and your ongoing patience as I continue to just try to figure out how the hell to get myself back on track and invent this new workflow and things like that. Yeah, and Proselys also did post links to some of the things I was producing. He posted a link to Shipbreaker in the chat. And then he posted a link to my article. I referenced my own article about why D&D 3.5 is the best. So I'm going to ask for a couple of favors. Number one, of course, if you have an answer to the puzzler, this is not a favor, but if you want a chance to win a pair of +5 smarty pants, go ahead and email your answer to angry.puzzler@angrygames before the date that I said, which was flipping pages, August 7th at noon. That is when I will hold the drawing, though I will not announce the winner until the next live chat. Alyssa just showed up. Thank you for showing up just as I'm shutting down. But hello. Good to see you. Number two, if I put threads up for Q&As, especially for Q and Angry, don't sleep on asking questions. Go ahead and put questions on there. Some people have expressed concern. They don't want to ask questions because they're afraid their questions will be redundant or it'll be covered in a future article or whatever. I know in the past I've been a little abusive about people asking the wrong questions wrong. I've done it mainly because it's funny, but I've also lost track of one of the essential truths of being the angry GM, and that is being a deliberate asshole is still being an asshole, and I need to temper that behavior. But also, because I'm gathering the questions in advance, I have the opportunity to vet them. Just because people ask me a question doesn't mean I have to answer it. And I can figure out how best to address it and not get caught off guard and have to figure out something to say, which is usually when I start making fun of someone. Usually I'm making fun of someone because I've been caught off guard and I need a minute to think about the question. So, but yeah, please don't hold back. The only thing I ask is don't write a paragraph, because I still have to be able to translate your question into basically one or two sentences, which was particularly difficult with today's recording. So, you know, try to cut to the point and just ask the question and move on. You don't need to connect it to what I was talking about. I will do that. I'll be like, oh yeah, you asked this because I brought up this, this, and this. And if I get your question slightly wrong, you're still going to get very interesting information, I promise. So don't be shy about asking questions. I'm also going to remind everybody that comments on my website, on the actual the Angry GM website, they do actually help out. They do help improve ranking in search engines. Okay, a bit. You know, it's not a huge impact, but I've been, you know, I've been saying, hey, you know, see if you can leave a comment. Plus, it just sparks more discussion. So if you have a comment or whatever, and, you know, I hate to do this. I hate to say comment, subscribe, feed the algorithm and stuff, because this isn't a friggin' YouTube channel yet. But while there is a reason why I am showing more concern for visibility and why I'm trying to branch out into podcasting and start looking at getting more exposure on other platforms. But in the meanwhile, if it occurs to you, if a question occurs to you or something, and or not a question, because that's good for Q and Angry, but if there's a comment or something you want to make or a discussion you want to start, you know, go ahead and start it on the website or start it at both. If you want to talk about it in the Angry article discussion, that's great. But also throw the comment on the website. You might get twice as many answers and they might be interesting. So, you know, just try to comment if you have a chance. That's all. I would really appreciate that. Beyond that, like I said, thank you everyone for your support, your patience, your encouragement. Thank you all for all of the well wishes as I keep drifting in and out of contact, as things keep being very unsettled for me. I get a lot of messages from people just wishing me well and making sure that I'm okay and giving me a thumbs up. And those really, really mean a lot, even if I don't necessarily get a chance to respond to them. That is really appreciated, and that is more appreciated than the financial support. Although without the financial support, the Angry GM would go away. But, you know, from a mental health standpoint, the encouragement actually counts for more. All right, and now I'm belaboring the point. So that's it. I will talk to you all in mid-August. And until then, everybody, I guess, I don't know, game angry. Yeah, ooh, game angry. You know, stay angry, be angry. Find a reason to be angry and be it.